Introducing Bluehost Cloud, ultra-fast WordPress hosting with 100% uptime. Want a website with unmatched power, speed, and control? Of course you do. And now you can have all three with Bluehost Cloud, the new web hosting plan from Bluehost. With 100% uptime and incredibly speedy load times, your WordPress websites will be dependable and lightning fast on a global scale. Plus, your sites can handle even the biggest traffic spikes without going down or lagging. And with Bluehost Cloud, you get 24/7 WordPress priority support, meaning you're connected to WordPress experts anytime you need them. Not to mention, you automatically get daily backups and world-class security. So, what are you waiting for? Get Bluehost Cloud today by visiting Bluehost.com. That's Bluehost.com.
Hello, everybody. I'm John Donvan. This is Intelligence Squared. And I'm sure you have heard the lament about America's universities, or at least many of its most elite universities, that they don't just lean left in the politics of most of their faculties and administration. And that's a claim that has a lot of support behind it, research behind it. But also, and here's where the claim gets a little bit more contentious, that many of these same elite universities are so captured by the left that competing viewpoints are stifled on campus. And so is free speech, and so is debate. Well, here at Intelligence Squared, our ears perk up when we hear the words debate and stifled in the same sentence. If that is going on campus, we want to look into it. We want to talk about it. We want to test that claim. And so to our topic for this edition of Agree to Disagree, the news of a new university being birthed in direct response to the perceived intellectual intolerance of American academia. This school has not enrolled any students yet, but it has a name, the University of Austin. And our guests are two of its founders, Pano Canellos and Neil Ferguson. Pano and Neil, thanks so much for joining us on Agree to Disagree.
Great to be with you.
Happy to be here.
Neil, you are a historian out of the Hoover Institute at Stanford. And Pano Canellos, you are now the president of the new University of Austin, formerly the president of St. John's College. I want to start with you, Pano. What is, as of today, the University of Austin?
The University of Austin is an institution that is being built as we speak. We are building a four-year comprehensive university that will have undergraduate and graduate programs located in the Austin area. And it's a university that's going to be first and foremost and unapologetically committed to open inquiry and civil discourse. The flag that we've planted in terms of the, let's say, the landscape of higher education is that we feel that we need institutions of higher learning to recommit to the fearless pursuit of truth. I would say that the dangers at hand in higher education, the Scylla and Charybdis that we're trying to navigate, are on the one hand, a kind of sense that everything is relative, that truth needs to be abandoned, that that there's just kind of a black hole out there, and we have to do the best we can, even as educators, to either ignore the black hole or avoid it. And on the other side of the fence is the sense that institutions have committed wholeheartedly to very distinct and orthodox versions of the truth and are interested in implementing those versions rather than interrogating the questions that they raise. So, you know, we're trying to thread that needle. We're trying to thread it by, as I said, committing to civil discourse, open debate, free inquiry, freedom of conscience. We feel that that's where universities should locate themselves.
Neil, I want to put the same question to you. What is the University of Austin?
The University of Austin is a startup. It's an attempt to create a new university offering, as Pano says, undergraduate and graduate programs, because we believe that there is room in the market for an institution that really means it about academic freedom and free speech as a means to the end of the pursuit of truth. Now, you might say, surely there are too many colleges in the United States, and relative to the population of people coming through the pipeline, we should be closing, not opening, colleges. But If one looks at the current state of higher education, there's obviously something wrong. And anybody who's in higher education or has been in the last few years knows it. If your experience is 10 years or more in the past, you don't know what we're talking about, because things have changed relatively swiftly, relatively recently. Heterodox Academy does a regular campus expression survey. 62% of college students in the last survey said that the climate on their campus prevents them from saying things they believe. The Chaley Institute for Global Innovation did a survey of students in four-year undergraduate programs earlier this year. 85% of self-described liberal students said they would report a professor to the university if the professor said something that students found offensive. 76% said they'd report another student. And in another study on academic freedom by the Center for the Study of Partisanship and Ideology, it was shown that something like three quarters of conservative American and, by the way, British academics in social sciences and humanities said there was a hostile climate for their beliefs in the department. And interestingly, the intolerance of unorthodox political views seems to increase with as the age of academics goes down. So younger academics are especially likely to support notional dismissal campaigns if somebody steps out of line. The Foundation for Individual Rights in Education has a database of issues relating to academic speech, showing that with every passing year, there are more cases of academics being sanctioned with investigations or even resignation, suspension of employment and other such sanctions. And that's the kind of thing that we are all concerned about. And I think everybody should be concerned about, because it's clearly not good if universities are the institutions in America where free speech is most restricted and where academic freedom has ceased to be meaningful. I mean, what's tenure if you can be suspended without pay for 2 years after investigation into something you said? Now, in that climate, there's clearly a need for a new institution that can just model academic freedom. And I feel passionately that that modest objective is something that everybody should support, because if we succeed, and I think we shall succeed, then we set an example for the more established institutions by reminding them that universities are places for free inquiry and expression, not for the indoctrination of students and the policing of faculty views.
So let's talk about, since you both live university lives, what's an example of, you know, concrete example of some suppressed truth, or actually you're talking about a process, suppressed truth interrogation, where it's clear you feel that an untruth is being promulgated and being sustained as a result of this dynamic going on campus.
I'll offer an opening bid here and then let Neil follow up. I would say, it is held to be true by a great many people that all relations between human beings are ultimately and exclusively relations of power. And from that assumption, other assumptions branch out. I don't think that's accurate. Or let's put it this way, I don't think it is comprehensively true. I think human relations are vastly more complicated than that. But if you distill it down to that formulation, then you can make other assumptions about civil society, about history, about politics. So if you start with a mistaken or naive assumption, you know, there are a trail of errors that can follow from that.
I'll give you an example. According to a recent survey by the Legatum Institute in London, 86% of American professors believe that systemic racism is a problem in the United States. That's a much larger proportion than the percentage of the public that believes that, which is just over half, 57%. Now, I think one should be able to have a debate about this, because the term systemic racism itself seems to be one that could be scrutinized. And it would certainly not be difficult to show with survey data from around the world that, in fact, the United States is one of the least racist societies. For example, if one asks people, would they be prepared to have a member of a different race as a neighbor? The percentage that says no is very low in the United States relative to most other countries in the world. The problem on American campuses today is that one can't have this debate. And here I want to make a very important distinction that's often forgotten. I have no objection at all to there being a hypothesis that there is systemic racism. And I have no objection at all to studying the works of authors who make this argument, proponents of critical race theory. I hope students at the University of Austin will be able to study the works of, say, Ibram X. Kendi. But the problem is that those who take that position regard the counterarguments as illegitimate and refuse to engage in a debate, merely questioning the good faith of the other side by saying, if you don't believe in systemic racism, then you must be a racist. This illustrates a really important point. We at the University of Austin are in favor of ideas of debate of the Socratic method. What we are most opposed to is that the methods, the tactics used on many university campuses today to shut down that kind of debate. And this is the key issue. It's not that there's a systematic campaign against truth going on. There's a systematic campaign against debate going on. And that's the critical issue. I'm happy to discuss the proposition that the United States suffers from systemic racism. But let's discuss it. Let's debate it. Let's also hear the counterargument. But we don't hear the counterargument, because if you make the counterargument, you're accused of racism. Ibram Kendi's argument is that unless you are on his side an anti-racist, you must be a racist. That's not how academic debate should function. And unfortunately, what we see in the American Academy today is a rapid retreat from the academic world that I knew in the 1980s, in which one could argue even the most controversial position without fear. One could, as a student, say something quite deliberately provocative and contrarian, perhaps completely wrong, but have no subsequent sanctions, to an atmosphere in which everyone is walking on eggshells for fear that they may say something that will lead them to be, in contemporary parlance, cancelled. That's the issue, that we can't seem to have debates on this issue, or take the example of sex and gender. There is clearly a distinction between biological sex and ideas of sexuality and gender. But when Kathleen Stock, who's one of our founding faculty fellows, published a book and has made the argument that biological sex, the difference between men and women, is a fundamental reality, she found herself subjected to a campaign of harassment on the Sussex University campus that finally forced her to resign because her life became intolerable. The issue is really about methods and tactics. It's not any ideas we're against. Methods that seem to me to be at fault here.
I want to talk a little bit about that atmosphere that you're talking about, because it seems to be your argument that the necessity for the University of Austin comes about because of this intolerable atmosphere, which is severely limiting and compromising the pursuit of truth. And you mentioned the case of Kathleen Stock in the UK, who, as I understand it, ultimately was advised to get security because of potential threats against her life. That's a quite extreme case. Or maybe you're going to tell me it's not extreme, but let me explain it this way. If in the absence of death threats, in the absence of people throwing rocks through your window, which is extreme and should not happen, and nobody's going to condone that, why are you not depicting the argumentation, the pressure, even the criticism, as part of the robust give and take of university life in itself. In other words, if you're a lone conservative on a campus where people don't like your points of view, make it known that they don't like your points of view, even call you a racist, why not pull on your big boy pants and stay in the fight and engage in the fight rather than retreat to a safer place? Why not stick around for the fight? Again, I'm talking about not in the situation that Kathleen Stock was in, but just in the situation where you're made to feel not very welcome. Why not tough it out?
Well, this is a naive question, with all due respect. The problem at so many universities is not that there is a debate, albeit one with name-calling. The problem is that academics face not just harassment or abuse, but they face active disciplinary proceedings if they fall foul of not only student opinion, but the sentiment of administrators. As Sam Abrams showed in an article some time ago for the New York Times, whereas it's clear that faculty are well to the left relative to the nation as a whole, and more than was the case 40 or even 20 years ago, administrators who've proliferated in numbers are even further to the left. And the difficulty is that a significant number of people in university administrations believe that if a colleague steps over one of the many red lines established by woke theory, then there must be consequences. Peter Boghossian is another founding faculty fellow of the University of Austin, and Peter has been on the receiving end of a quite different kind of campaign from the one that Kathleen Stock encountered, in which he was subjected to investigations, disciplinary proceedings by the administration of his own university, Portland State. Why? Because he and two other authors had successfully published spoof articles in supposedly serious scholarly journals on gender and other forms of sociological and cultural study. And so there were actual consequences for Professor Boghossian that ultimately made his position at Portland State intolerable. So one has to recognize that the pathology in academia is not just that the debate got ugly. Trust me, I'm from Glasgow. I can handle ugly debate, and I've been taught all my life, sticks and stones may break my bones, names will never hurt me. But the other side says, oh, no, that names do hurt me. And if I'm made to feel uncomfortable by something that Professor X says, there must be consequences because I must be protected from hate speech. Now, hate speech is just contemporary jargon for blasphemy or heresy. We have somehow reverted to a quasi-religious environment in which there are certain beliefs you cannot hold. And a significant proportion of academics and administrators believe that, for example, social justice concerns should always be prioritized, even if it violates academic freedom. 27% of people in the Legatum Institute survey that I mentioned just a moment ago, 27% of professors in that survey think that social justice should take precedence over academic freedom. In the University of California, you can't even apply for a position if you're not willing to sign a declaration of your commitment to diversity, equity, and inclusion. Well, these kinds of things resemble the kinds of religious tests that used to be required of academics in the 18th and 19th century.
Well, let me jump to Pano on that. I hear your point on it, and I want to take your point to Pano and ask you, Pano, is it the case that virtually all faculty and perhaps some students who hold conservative views on these campuses have their careers at risk?
I think that every conservative faculty member that I've had a conversation with on this subject feels the ambient pressure of risk. So yes, I mean, I can't, you know, Neil's much better with surveys than I am, but I would say it is widespread. And just to give you a data point, Within a week of announcing that we were opening a university dedicated to open inquiry and civil discourse, we received over 3,500 inquiries for employment from faculty at other institutions.
Wow. American faculty or global?
There were some international, but predominantly American. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that number in and of itself speaks to, you know, these are people from institutions across the country and in other parts of the world, speaks to the situation they find themselves in. I mean, to imagine searching out a university that hasn't even yet begun offering classes and looking to inquire to work there. I think that tells us what we need to know. I want to just revert back quickly to the point you made about creating a safe space. We expect the University of Boston to be quite a dangerous place in the sense that ideas are really, really meant to be challenged and debated. We just don't think that there should be personal risk that attends being wrong or being heterodox. We think that when you add personal risk to that kind of intellectual scrum, people inevitably will revert to something that is safer for them. And therefore, we lose out on the opportunity to really test the mettle of ideals. We have no interest whatsoever in creating a conservative university. We have zero interest. I mean, we're using sometimes conservative faculty as examples here, but Kathleen Stock and Peter Boghossian are not conservatives. They are people of the left, as are many other people affiliated with our institution. Our goal is to create an environment that is really ecumenical in nature, that welcomes all comers, so long as those comers abide by the rules of civil discourse and allow each other to be open, honest, as truthful as we can be, and graceful when we feel that we've been offended.
Pano, if we were making the movie of the founding of the University of Austin, take me back to the first scene. How did the group of trustees find each other? Who are you? When literally did those discussions begin? Where did they begin? Tell us that story.
Well, I'd say there were a sort of overlapping networks of discussions between the founders of this institution and broader circles of people had been going on for years. People have been talking about new institutions for years. But the immediate founders of this institution, we had our first meeting in the late spring this year here in Austin. And it was Neil was present there, Barry Weiss, Heather Hying, and Joe Lonsdale, along with Arthur Brooks, who was there to help us think through issues. And we gathered for
and what was the impetus for the five of you to get together for that meeting? Who called it?
We had communicated amongst ourselves that we wanted to have an initial discussion about starting a new university, and so we wanted to get together face to face and think about the see if we agreed in principle about what such a university should stand for. And then think about the practicalities of starting a new university. So that was the kind of first, mini summit that we had. And it was a moment where the meeting of minds was profound and the sense of urgency was profound. And so we began launching it from that moment. So really this has been something of a rocket ship. I mean, this is not... This project as it stands, which I do think is the fruit of many other conceived projects, but this current project has really been taking off over the, during this year, 2021.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts, so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
I find it interesting that the three of us were students of the humanities. You were an English major, I believe, at Northwestern and studied and taught theater earlier in your career. And Neil, of course, an historian. I'm an English major, but The university has a heavy emphasis on tech, I understand. Neil?
Well, I think the distinction between arts and sciences has been a somewhat problematic one for a long, long time, as C.P. Snow criticized it before I was born. I come from a family of physicists and I'm the black sheep of the family, but I've always studied history with a scientific background and framework. My most recent book uses quite a lot of scientific research on the history of disasters, including pandemics, and the one before that imported a good deal of network science. So for me, this distinction has always been a somewhat meaningless one. And a good education, an undergraduate education, as well as a high school education, should be broad. It should not exclude the science majors from the works of Shakespeare or philosophy or history, and it shouldn't exclude the historians and philosophers from the laws of physics. The goal at the University of Austin is to build from a small foundation, a summer school, which will start as a kind of pilot project, a master's program in entrepreneurship and leadership. And that will be our first master's program. And then we'll follow that with a succession of other programs, including one on politics and applied history, which is very much up my street, and another on engineering technology and mathematics, which I think illustrates our commitment to an educational philosophy that is broad and does not put in silos the scientists on one side and the humanities on the other side and the social scientists in the middle. That's I think, what made for an educational revolution in the Renaissance. It made for tremendous advances in education in the 19th century when universities really modernized themselves. And the goal used to be at the great universities of the United States that undergraduates would spend 2 years studying a broad range of subjects and only concentrate or major in the third and fourth year. What I found in teaching at Harvard was that that principle was honored mainly in the breach, and that what had occurred was such a proliferation of options, such a stupendous number of courses, that undergraduates swiftly worked out the way to game the system to make sure that their GPA stayed as high as possible. That's the kind of thing that we want to avoid at the University of Austin. We want a genuinely broad undergraduate program to be established, and we want to make it difficult. There should not be soft courses where it's easy to get an A. I'd like to emphasize that the University of Austin will be hard.
Bano, speaking of hard or difficult, again, in your exit interview from St. John's, you talked about how many of the students who came there were not students who necessarily had fit well into the academic framework of high school and test taking, et cetera, but had a sort of native intelligence and curiosity. And in coming to St. John's, they were given the opportunity to flourish, and they did flourish. But they were not the high scorers on the SATs necessarily, or the kids with the 4.0 grade averages. Who are you hoping to attract to the University of Austin? The same sorts of students, a different group of students, or are you entirely agnostic on that question?
But I think there's probably significant overlap between the kind of student that would attend St. John's and the student who would come to University of Austin. I would say, even though many students who attended St. John's maybe did not have some of the traditional markers of academic success, they were aware when matriculating at St. John's that it was an intensely rigorous education, which will also be the case at University of Austin. So it's not simply that we're looking for students who maybe didn't quite align with, you know, their, in some important way, with their peers or with the education they've received as K through 12 students. But I think the through line for these students is that they're seeking an education that is going to be rigorous, comprehensive, that's going to be unsettling in some ways. And we will be looking for distinct markers of academic achievement when we admit students, because we think that you have to do that to be fair to students, to have a strong sense that they will be able to complete a program such as the one that we'll have. But you're also looking for that kind of, this sort of X factor as well. You know, what is propelling the student forward into their education? What are they seeking out of an education? I mean, I've said this in many contexts, and the purpose of higher education is not employment. The purpose of higher education is human flourishing, which does include employment, but the highest order of business in higher education is to seek ways to flourish as human beings. Those are the students who have that hunger, that are on that particular journey, the ones that are seeing their education as something that will provide them the best possible way to be the best possible human beings they can be. And in the course of this, probably pick up many, many skills that will allow them to be employed, but that's not the ultimate end. Those are the students we're looking for.
It's interesting. So often these days, the value of college education is the metric used is return on investment and lifetime career earnings. And you're saying that is not primary for you in setting up the college.
It's not primary at all, but I will say that my experience has been that students who whose first inclination, whose priority is something larger than career advancement, often tend to be the ones who do the best in their careers over time anyway, because they just have a meta presence, meta skills that are useful in many different contexts. Mm.
Neil has already stated that, for example, the intended heterodox nature of this university means that the teachings of a critical race theorist are in fact welcome, as long as it's in the context of being debatable. What about having will you welcome Marxist thinkers onto your faculty if they were to want to do that? I'm sure you might question whether they would, but would they be welcome if they're academically qualified?
But it's already happened because I am a Marxist.
Oh, thank you. I didn't know that.
It's just that I'm on the side of the bourgeoisie, but much of Marx's analysis of capitalist society was quite correct. Yeah. I just happen not to side with the proletariat, and it seems like the experiments with proletarian rule did not turn out terribly well. So we don't really have to debate this because we already have a Marxist as one of the founders.
I would say that we would welcome even Orthodox Marxists, to be honest. In fact, probably seek them out. Because again, I mean, this is how we learn. I mean, you know, and, you know, there, I don't know any systemic approach to thought that has been massively influential in our culture that we should dismiss outright. And that's, I think, the same thing with critical race theory. It's been extremely influential. It's something we should take very seriously, interrogate very seriously. There are things, I think, that can be learned from such a process. I don't think it's a matter of refutation or apologetics and proving which side is right and wrong. I think all of this, as Neil points out, Marxism is distilling things that we can learn from systems of thought that are ultimately never going to be comprehensive enough, because we're human beings and we're just.
Let me bring a perhaps more challenging case into the conversation. There is a professor at Old Dominion University who, just in the last few weeks, was essentially forced to resign because of their views, and I'm saying there because this professor is trans and uses the pronoun they there. They are there, them. This professor, Alan Walker, with strong credentials, degree from Columbia University and elsewhere, and well-published, had been making the case in a book that pedophiles were not universally predators and were seen that way, that there was such a thing as pedophilia without predation. And the professor portrayed their the situation of people who are in this category as being under an enormous amount of stress because of their predilections, but also their attempts to resist acting on these things. And to that degree, was sympathetic. It was in no way an endorsement of the acts of pedophilia, in no way, but it was depicted this way. And the professor came in for a storm of criticism, and under that pressure and in consultation with the administration, stepped down. And when we talk about, and by the way, I am in no way endorsing the views of the professor, but it does seem to me that this is a case of exactly the kind of uncomfortable, offensive conversation and thought that we're talking about pursued in an academic setting that challenges mores, but at the same time, the expulsion of the professor seems to be entirely built around the content of the argument that was being made. And I want to know, would this professor have room on your faculty?
I mean, I don't know enough other than what you've described, and what I've read in the media, glancingly. I don't know enough to give a direct answer to that. What I would say—
So an indirect answer, yeah.
But indirectly, what I would say is there are boundaries around speech. The purpose of a university is, in fact, not free speech. It's speech that is conducive to learning, right? So a university is not a soapbox. You don't offer the university campus simply for people to express their opinions. You offer a university campus for people to bring forward their opinions and allow those opinions to be queried and stress test and tested. So are there opinions that are beyond the pale? There are lines, I think, and I think reverting back to the principle of civil discourse, the civil discourse has three components to it. The first is that you approach questions with intellectual humility. The second component, which is the salient one here, is that you accept unequivocally the dignity of all human beings, and because we're all rational creatures, and that's what allows us to discourse. And the third is that you have a passion for truth. When someone's speech or someone's ideas impinge upon the dignity of other human beings in ways that are purposeful or cruel, intended or not, that's where you have to have serious discussions. And I mean, I'm not saying there's the clearest line there, but you know, that's where you start to draw red lines around. And I think in a case like this, that's what should be debated. Like, are those lines crossed?
So what you would be saying in this case is you would look at the case to see if those lines are being crossed. You're not, you know, prima facie saying because the person is in any way sympathetic to the situation of pedophiles, that's a disqualifier in and of itself. And it's that position which cost this professor their job.
Yeah, I mean, you know, what's in somebody's heart is different from what somebody brings into their classroom and their work as a scholar. And I think when somebody's bringing that into their scholarship or bringing that into the classroom, things get blurry very quickly. And that's, you know... Yeah, that's what I'd say about that.
I may say that there's been some debate and difference of views amongst our advisors on this particular case. And I think it's a good illustration of the challenges that any institution committed to academic freedom will sooner or later face. My view is that we do not want to have a cancel culture of the conservatives to match the cancer culture of the woke, and that we would certainly, I'm sure, and Pano would agree with this, be very reluctant indeed at the University of Austin to dismiss or otherwise penalize a faculty member on the basis that somebody found their research offensive. That seems like a pretty bad basis for a decision about an academic career. My own forthcoming book on the case for eating children will probably get me into a certain amount of trouble with my critics, but I'm sure Panna will uphold my right to study the work of Jonathan Swift and publish on it freely. This is a joke.
It was not a bad joke, but you did it so dryly we weren't convinced. Another sort of concrete example I want to bring into the conversation, because it happens at a lot of universities, is situations where professors, particularly law professors, and it's also happening in literature classes, will make explicitly vocalize the N-word in a context in which they are quoting, they feel legitimately, either the literature or there's a case that I found interesting on the FIRE website of a professor at the University of Illinois, Chicago, at the Marshall Law School. His name is Jason Kilbourn, and he had an exam question in which he was portraying the complaint of an African-American woman who had been slandered and slurred at work by her employer. And in the question that he wrote describing the situation, he said that he had used a pejorative that began with the letter N and the one that began with the letter B. He did not spell out the words, but in itself, that provoked a response of disgust and offense on the part of many students who did, as Neil said, report that professor for using even the letters without the fully spelled out words. I just want to know, what will be the university's take on this situation that comes up again and again in terms of specific use of language that some people will find, you used the term before, beyond the pale. That this would be beyond the pale.
Before Panna answers in his capacity as president, let me offer the following observation. This is much simpler. I used to teach at Oxford years ago a special subject on the Third Reich. We used a great many primary source documents. And I am at a loss to know how one could teach the history of the Third Reich without studying Hitler's speeches, the Nuremberg Laws, Nazi propaganda, all of which are shot through with anti-Semitic slurs. The whole notion that one can't teach content that includes offensive language is preposterous. And if students don't understand the distinction between using a word as a slur and explaining the way in which a word was used as a slur in a racist regime, then they really need to go back to high school and do some basic training before they go to university. For me, it's absolutely open and shut. These cases are preposterous, and university administrations who capitulate, who yield to this kind of pressure and don't defend their faculty's right to use inappropriate ways offensive language in context, are utterly failing in their duty. That's my opinion, but Panna will speak in his role as president probably a great deal more arenically than me.
I would say that I think I agree with what Neil's saying entirely. I guess what I would add to it is what we seem to have lost is the connection between culpability and intentionality. for something to be offensive, truly offensive, there has to be the intention to offend. That doesn't mean somebody can't be offended secondhand or inadvertently, but the culpability that accrues to that it's not of the same order. If somebody is offended and then expresses their offense to somebody, the recourse should be to apologize or to speak to that person in a way that brings greater clarity to both parties, not to discipline and punish. And so we have to return, we have to recommit to the notion that to be culpable for some sort of wrong, you have to intend to do that wrong. And, I certainly don't think in these cases where somebody is using a slur for educational purposes, almost always and intentionally to undermine the inherent problematic nature of that term and to teach what needs to be taught about what really is at heart offensive or racist about these terms, you know, to turn that inside out. I mean, I think that seems to me to be illogical.
I want to point out that Intelligence Squared, we've done a number of debates around the topics of university education and including some of what we're talking about now. So I want to refer folks to the debate we did where the resolution was liberals are stifling intellectual diversity on campus. We also took on a debate where the resolution was safe spaces are dangerous. And it's that one that I want to refer to. In that debate, we were not actually debating the thing we're talking about right now, which is what can be said in a classroom or what can't be said in a classroom. We were more talking about the issue of whether universities should offer places where students from marginalized communities can go, dormitories, clubs, et cetera, to have their own place. But implicit in that argument was that there are things happening in the classroom that can be so offensive to them as to be traumatic. And I want to quote from what the president of Wesleyan University, Michael Roth, said. Again, the resolution, our safe space is dangerous. And he was saying no. But then he said, what's dangerous is to make believe that everybody who comes to a university is an equal participant in transactions. And that's not just not true when you go to a school that has a history of discrimination and prejudice and where you are a newcomer and where you're trying very hard to belong. And implicit in that argument and throughout that debate was the idea that as American universities have made efforts in the last 30 years to appeal to, attract, and enroll a broader range of America's social fabric, that people are coming into that organization, into those institutions who are inherently more vulnerable to the impact of language, that it's a real thing, that people can be traumatized by words. I know that you said earlier, sticks and stones can break my bones, but words can never hurt me. I've heard that many times in this conversation, but I'm wondering, again to you, Pano, the degree to which, even as you hold the line that you've spelled out here, you are empathetic or sympathetic to the experience of these students, whether you feel any sort of accommodation needs to be made, for example, perhaps signaling the word by its initial as opposed to spelling it out, whether any of those accommodations, kind of in the interest of civility, would be called for at the University of Austin.
I mean, look, again, the last course I taught at St. John's was on Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man, which is an extremely charged text. and I selected it specifically after the summer of the murder of George Floyd, because I thought that this was a moment where we needed to dive together into some very, very complex and profound issues, even though I knew it was going to be challenging. It is a book filled not only with very distressing episodes of racism, but there's sexism, sexual assault. I mean, it's a very challenging work. And we began that class very first day by agreeing together to a premise. And I said, look, we are here as human beings to learn together. We will best learn together by taking this challenging text in hand and finding ways into it, sharing our ideas, knowing that as we do this, we are in danger of offending one another with the things that we say, knowing that we are very likely going to find ourselves set on edge by the propositions that somebody makes or language within the text. The only way we can learn together through this is if we begin from a position of grace and forgiveness, that we are all earnestly well-intentioned, that we are doing this together for our common learning and for our individual edification, so that when we do come up against these sharp edges, our impulse is to forgive and to express, you know, the whatever offense we might feel, but know that the person on the other side is a human being who's capable of mistakes, and that as we ourselves are. So I think the way to address what you're talking about, this sort of sense of the need to be inclusive and create an atmosphere of belonging, is to wear our humanity on our sleeves with one another. That to me is the approach to take, not to separate each other, but to find the commonality and to express our own vulnerability. I mean, I was the president of a college. I told them I was terrified to read that book with them because it was sort of uncharted waters, especially at that charged moment in history. But being able to share that with them enabled us to have, I would say, one of the best classes I've ever taught.
I was going to ask that. How did that class turn out?
It was phenomenal. The students were so mature. It wasn't easy, but it was phenomenal. They were so mature, and the response afterwards was that this was what they needed at that vexed moment in time, the ability to be open with each other in this kind of way. Now, you know, so that's my response to your question.
Yeah, it's very, very, very full response, and it sounds as though, yeah, in a sense, you are willing to make an account. You're at least willing to acknowledge that this issue is there and to find an accommodation to it. Neil, if you were approached by Jewish students who asked you to please euphemize some of the language that was at least, okay, you can't euphemize if they're reading the text, but if you're speaking about it in the classroom, could you use euphemisms? Would you agree to do that in the interest of the kind of comity that I think Pano was just saying he would want to build in the classroom?
I'm assuming that Pano did not euphemize the language.
No, I'm not saying that he did. I'm asking whether you would.
I would refer them to one of my most brilliant students, Abigail Green, who's a professor at Oxford, who was an undergraduate in my Third Reich special subject class. I'd suggest that they speak to her, and I know what she would say.
Can you tell us?
She would, I'm absolutely certain, tell any student who made that request that the most important thing one can do as a historian, as a student of history, regardless of whether one is Jewish or not, is to stare evil in the face and try to at least attempt to understand why it happened. And one can't possibly do that if one uses soft focus and euphemisms. I never, at any time that I taught that course and I had numerous Jewish students, had anybody make such a suggestion.
It's interesting you say that. I was a foreign correspondent and covered wars, and often, well, always, we had to censor the images that we sent back from the battlefield, basically because of FCC standards, taste standards, community taste standards. And we were not able to show what we actually saw in the battlefield. And I was always very conflicted about that because it was always way worse than it looked on television. And I still to this day have regrets about that. It wasn't in my hands, but I nevertheless have regrets about that.
Let me interject. As a historian of war who's written books on both the First and Second World War, I think I very much oppose that kind of sanitization of war. And I think actually future historians will say that the American press bears some responsibility for sanitizing war and diminishing, downplaying the nature of its horrors. If one's to explain why the United States persistently involved itself in protracted, unsuccessful wars. So my style of teaching is perhaps unfashionably no holds barred, but my sense is that what we can do at a university that you can't maybe do on a television network is show students and encourage them to find out what things are really like. If we can't do that in a university, then we certainly won't be able to do it in our media. And as a result, truth will suffer another setback. War is hell. War is horrific. I understood that as a schoolboy because we studied the poems of Wilfred Owen. Should we sanitize those? Should we take the poetry of the mustard gas attacks and delete it in case anybody's traumatized? This is the kind of madness that I'm most passionately opposed to. if I could take it as a schoolboy, if I could contemplate dying of the inhalation of mustard gas as a schoolboy, then I think somebody old enough to be at university should be able to understand, study, make sense of, and be revolted by the language of Nazism, or for that matter, the language of segregation and slavery. I can't abide this attempt, whether it's in universities or in news organizations, to present the past through some kind of sepia-tinted lens. I think it's absolutely immoral, actually, and we have a moral imperative to pursue truth. We began this conversation by asking, what's truth? Well, truth is what actually happens when a bullet passes through the body of a young person. That's part of truth. Truth is what happened, what was said by Hitler in the speech in which he announced that if there were a war, that the Jews be annihilated. That is part of truth. And an institution of the sort that we're founding has to be committed to that kind of truth. And if undergraduates find it traumatizing, then my inclination is to say that's no bad thing, because the trauma that the people suffered who experienced these things at first hand was 10 orders of magnitude greater than the trauma you'll experience in a lecture hall contemplating photographs or film images.
In the few minutes we have left, I want to see where the seeds you have scattered have taken root and how they're taken root. Pano, you're the president of the university. Are you drawing a salary now?
I am, yes.
And are you the only person drawing a salary, or do you have staff? Do you have faculty on the payroll?
We have our kind of initial team that's working on setting up the university. So we have a small band of brothers and sisters who are helping get the institution launched, who are on the payroll. And we have the faculty we have on the payroll right now, what we're calling our founding faculty fellows. So they're short-term appointments from fellows who we feel exemplify the kind of courage that is needed in higher education today, and who are going to be teaching for us in our summer courses and offering some other lectures of sorts.
Are they like you relocating to Austin?
The administrative staff, yes. Most are, and some are still in process. The founding faculty fellows, no, these are temporary appointments, so they would not.
I see.
They'll be here to teach in person and to do other things.
How well funded is this university?
We have a significant amount of backing right now that gives us the runway we need to launch in 3 years, but we need to raise more money to do things like build the buildings on our campus that we're acquiring and build out the program. So we have a lot of wind in the sails, and the support has been really, really, really heartening.
You're applying for nonprofit tax status, correct? It's not going to be a for-profit institution. That's not the intention.
Oh, no, of course. Nonprofit, yes. I mean, nonprofit, we're going through all the normal channels for accreditation, the nonprofit university, an almost exclusively in-person university. We may have some applications for online education and on the fringes, but four-year comprehensive university like other universities that have existed for centuries.
Expensive place to go to school?
So we have a strong commitment to rethinking the financial model of higher education to make sure that higher education is accessible. And so we are planning on having a rather low tuition point. Our goal right now, we'll see how this evolves, but our goal right now is to have a tuition half of what you would find at most top flight universities. And to find ways to reduce the delivery cost of education by having the slimmest possible administration, and having a kind of campus life that's not let's say not the cruise ship model that you might find at some other schools.
So we're not expecting Olympic swimming pools and beautiful dining halls, that sort of thing.
We are not. What our motto is to beauty. I'm not giving up on beauty. Our motto is to keep it simple, make it beautiful. But simplicity can be beautiful.
And I know that one of your founders, Joe Lonsdale, is tech entrepreneur who's been very successful in business and is, I'm sure, a significant supporter. Do you have multiple donors at this point?
We have many donors at this point, multiple seven-figure plus donors. And I think even more excitingly, I think at last count, we had over 600 donors at the kind of grassroots level. And that was, it's actually probably significantly higher. I don't remember the last time I looked at that. So, which is even more important to me because that's a kind of validation, you know, along with realizing that there are thousands of faculty out there who want to teach at this institution. The idea that people out there who just see this budding building institution and will go on our website and give us $50 or $100 or $1,000 out of a kind of enthusiasm for the project. To me, that's just validating.
So that's interesting. You are getting those sort of small donations.
We really are. We really are. And they've been coming in since the moment we announced. I mean, it's rather extraordinary. I mean, it really is. Remember, we're an institution that's trying to raise money that has no alumni. I mean, not only do we not have, you know, courses, we'd have no alumni. And that's normally where you would turn as a university for your major sources of philanthropy. Our philanthropy is coming from people who believe in the mission of the institution, but don't have any personal history with the institution.
So to both of you, I assume, given the opportunity, if the timing were to work out right, I don't know where you are in your stages of life, but if you were to have college-aged children, you would be quite happy to see them attend the University of Austin, turn down the Stanfords, the Harvards, the Princetons, the Yales, and go to Austin.
Well, Malcolm Gladwell said that's exactly what he would do if he were that age. I have a 9-year-old and a 4-year-old. Of older kids in their 20s have already been through university. And I think when I look at my young ones, I ask myself, where would they get the kind of intellectual experience that I had at Oxford in the 1980s, which was extraordinarily invigorating, incredibly ideologically diverse? We had Marxists, we had liberals, we had ultra-Tories, where we were able to speak our minds, no matter how silly the ideas were, without disastrous consequences for our careers. Where would they go? And there isn't anywhere. And we're building it. So I absolutely hope that we can succeed in creating an institution that will be much more attractive than the established institutions, precisely because it will be the most intellectually invigorating atmosphere, not only in America, but we should aspire even higher than that in the world. I've sounded somewhat dour in much of our discussion because you've asked questions that have made me feel that way. But actually, I'm enormously excited about this project precisely because it solves the problem that I currently confront, even in educating my younger children now. Even at the stage of junior school, I am encountering the kind of problems of indoctrination that I find most disconcerting in universities. So I'm pretty confident, I don't know if you agree, Panna, but I'm pretty confident that we will attract the adventurous thinkers. We'll attract the students who want to be able to take risk, who don't crave to be wrapped in cotton wool, but want dangerous ideas, who will crave the stimulus of people with whom they disagree and contemporaries with whom they can disagree. I was such an arguer when I was 18, 19, 20, and I'd have been absolutely crushed if I'd got to Oxford and been told, oh, don't speak your mind, you might get cancelled. Oh, don't say that in class, that'll really cost you your grades. I would have been crushed if I'd been told that. So what makes me most excited about the University of Austin is I know it's going to be a magnet for the brilliant, the edgy, the risk-taking thinkers. And those, of course, are the people who do in the end change the world, not because they set out to make lots of money. They don't. They set out to think the most interesting thoughts, to dare to think. That was Immanuel Kant's great imperative, the less famous of his imperatives. Sapere aude, dare to think. That's the spirit of the University of Austin. And yes, Thomas and Campbell, my youngest children, I very much who will turn down Harvard, Yale, Stanford, Princeton, and all the other universities that will make them offers and go to the cutting edge where the excitement is always to be found in all walks of life.
Neil, I'm glad to see that you lifted your mood, and I want to thank you for taking part in the conversation, and you as well, Pano Canales. Thank you so much for joining us on Intelligence Squared Agree to Disagree. We'll check back with you in a few years for a progress update. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
I want to thank you, our audience, for tuning into this episode of Intelligence Squared. I hope you enjoyed it just as much as I did. Intelligence Squared is a nonprofit that is generously funded by listeners like you, members of Intelligence Squared, academic institutions and other partners, and by the Rosencrantz Foundation. Clea Connor is our CEO. David Ariosto is our head of editorial. Amy Kraft is our chief of staff and head of production. Shay O'Mara and Marlette Sandoval are our producers. Kim Strempel is our production coordinator. Damon Whittemore is our audio producer, and Robert Rosencrantz is our chairman. Our mission here at Intelligence Squared is to restore critical thinking and facts and reason and civility to American public discourse. We would love your support in that effort. Please visit www.intelligencesquaredus.org to join the debate and hear from both sides, at least both sides, of every issue. I'm John Donvan. Thanks so much for listening.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.